No, it should be working. Good. Well, welcome. And it's nice to be here and a pleasure to be here. I don't know that that's the reputation that, you know, that's passed around from person to person amongst the brethren, but it is my pleasure. Sister Dorothy and I had 6 girls and 2 boys, so we had lots of girls in our life. We have 28 grandchildren, and 21 of them are girls. So it's the exact same proportion in our family as with our grandchildren. There's 3 girls for every boy. So it's something we've had to specialize a little bit in. And I can still remember having to find place in the house for everybody, because with 8 children, you've got to spread yourself out a bit. So we had an old farmhouse, and we took the attic and fixed it up so that you could live in it. But it was slope roof like this, so the beds were on the edge, and you wouldn't want to get up too quick in the morning because you hit your head. And there were 4 girls up there, and they managed to survive. And it was really quite interesting, because when you're that close to the roof, the mice seem to be coming right down by your head. You can hear them, and there was all kinds of other activities. It was an old farmhouse, about 100 years old. So, but they enjoyed it. They were together. The only thing I remember is some mornings when they went to school, I heard a voice saying, "That's mine." And had 1 closet, and all the clothes were in the 1 closet, and they first out got the pick. So it was kind of fun. Anyway, what we wanted to talk about today was of the list that I suggested to the brethren. This is what they chose, and it related to speaking. Now, I'm not sure that you would just immediately pick up on this, so we got to be careful how we introduce this. The wisdom of Solomon was to see that there was a time for everything. Almost everything. He listed a lot of things, and you would be pressed, really, if you went through the whole list to try to find some example of everything in the Bible. Well, I think there is. There is a time for gathering stones and a time to disperse them. And if you go through the scriptures, you can actually find examples of when they did those things. And I think that's where you start on a study, is to do that. So we wanted to concentrate on this one thing, and that is a time to keep silence and a time to speak. Now, a lot of people think they would know where I'm going with this, but it probably, it's not in that direction. Because what I wanted to say was, first of all, to be aware of this. I just want to get out of that particular area where I'm speaking. It doesn't sound too good to me, but there's a different format and different actions when you think of speaking. For instance, you can communicate orally with people. You can talk to them as we are, or you could actually communicate by writing things to one another. You could do it by electronic communications. As you know, people can do this with little devices while you're listening to something, you're talking to somebody else. But you can do it in different languages. Not that I really mean languages like French and English, but you could do it through body language. You can speak, you can demonstrate what you mean, you change positions sharply or something like that, you're indicating something. You can wear slogans on your body. When you walk around with these slogans on, you're communicating with people, they see them, they think of different thoughts because you're wearing them. Your degree of participation, like you're really into it, or you're just sitting back and you're doing nothing. There is all kinds of ways to communicate. And of course, the company that you keep. So now I think they all fit into the big umbrella. There's a time to be silent and a time to speak. So if we're conscious of that, and we're a little hesitant to say, to just speak orally, to get up and stand up and speak to people, we might at the same time want to participate by wearing a slogan. So if we're in a company of people, we want people to know where we stand without talking to them, we could wear something on our shirts, which a lot of young people do, to illustrate by that alone, without saying a word to them, where we stand. I think that's an excellent way of communication. But then there's another way you can look at this. There's different circumstances and different actions because of it. For instance, the way you communicate in the company of family members would probably be different than any other group of people you're with, your family. You would not likely communicate by written communications when you're talking to your kids in the house, though you might have a notice for them now and then, but you would probably be speaking some otherwise. In the company of the ecclesia, you have another way of which you're communicating. In the company of sisters only, you would have things that you would say in the way you communicate. If you're in the company of children only, you communicate in another way, which may, you know, involve some of the things in the last slide. In the company of the public who know nothing about what we believe, you would be communicating in a different way. You would communicate differently in solitude because, you know, some people might be out walking down a path somewhere and there's no one around. You're singing or you're talking. I do that myself, so I assume you do too. And sometimes it's really interesting to do that because I find meditation quite often involves just speaking out loud. So you're in solitude in a sense. And then, of course, in prayer while you're in solitude. So if you're speaking to God, that's got another context. So this is a huge subject. And you can go down any one of these roads to try to develop some idea of what it means. There's a time to be silent, and there's a time to speak. Now, I think this is very, very important. If anybody is in the age of Sister Dorothy and I, you probably think of it more of regretting to say something than you do of remembering something that you said and you're glad that you said it. Like there was an age when you could have communicated with the child and you had the opportunity to talk to them, but, you know, it just seemed like things got in the way and other things happened and, you know, finally the children have left your home and you never did communicate. And one of the things that I feel I would love to have told my children, if I had the chance I would do it again, is the need to know how to forgive and to seek forgiveness. Because there isn't a single child that would ever leave our house, no matter what kind of company we made for them, what kind of communication we had with them, that would not need to know that when they go out by themselves. Because we will fail, and we will need to forgive, and we'll need to be forgiven. If we've been brought up in a house where those things have been front and center, it will probably serve them as well as anything else they've ever been told. Because we will have to seek forgiveness. We'll have to know the procedure. So it's just things of that nature which I'm thinking of when it's a time to be silent or a time to speak. Now, the thing that really teaches this is our textbook. And there isn't anything else like it. So rather than go into any kind of psychology, I would rather just look at what the text says. And I want to do this in little clusters of quotations, the first of which we just get out of the way to start with. They're negative, but they are important to understand. That when it comes to the tongue, it's quite right that the apostle said, no one can tame it. It's like a wild animal that you can never be sure of. A wild animal that's untamable is likely to revert to the wild anytime. That's the way our tongue is. Given certain circumstances, we can say things we would have no intention of saying, but we just blurted it out because the way the situation developed around us until, you know, we found that we're stressed to the point of saying something that we shouldn't have said. So the tongue is something nobody can tame. It's an unruly evil. It's full of deadly poison. Therewith bless we God, even the Father. Therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceeds blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought so to be. And quite often we come to that recognition agreeing with the apostle because of the way it happened in our life. I think that's one of the things we want to reiterate in our home to our children. Like it's Bible school material. That's really what we're here for, is to try to reinforce values that when we go home, we can remember it. I don't know whether you can remember your grandmother and your mother's influence on you. Like, not everybody has come from a background where you were always in a Christadelphian family. But if you had a person who was like a Lois and a Eunice, you'd never forget it. And some of the things that my grandmother, I do remember her because she was quite unique. All of Dorothy's parents and my parents came from Britain. So we're very British. We're either Scotland or Ireland or England. And so just go through the family names and you can figure that out. But my grandmother on my mother's side was a very straight lady. She never had much to say that was humorous. In fact, I don't think I could ever remember her saying something just to generate humor. It was also matter of fact. She lived with her husband, which was also a brother, but they were in different fellowships. She was in the Don Fellowship and he was in the Berean Fellowship. And we were impressed with this when we were growing up, that these two would, that's Ontario, and we're still in that kind of trouble and difficulty in Ontario. And there's a number of brother and sisters that grew up with one parent being in one fellowship and the other being in another fellowship. But as time went on, I got to know why that was the case, and I had a great deal of respect for these people because my grandmother was the only one that could remember the First World War. She was the only one that could remember the Balfour Declaration, and she could remember the various things that happened in 1917 that brought Israel. So they were tuned to their radio at 11 o'clock at night. Like, I stayed with her when I was doing my work terms at university. So I got to know them quite well. She cooked the meal all the time. It was sort of minced meat with potatoes. And that was a standard food that we had to eat. There wasn't much variation of that. And so we got to love them and respect them. And my mother, again, my dad didn't read. He never read the readings with us. Mom always did the readings. Dad didn't. I don't think Dad really knew how to read. He was out of school so early in his life, out because of the 30s, and because his parents couldn't look after him, that Mom was the one that brought us up. And she was the one that insisted we did the readings. And when we come to, all of us in our family, we come to explain how we got our understanding and how we got our faith, we'd thank our mother for that. Although my dad had a very good understanding and a very good faith, he was not a teacher and he wasn't a Bible student in that sense. So, there's Lois and Eunice really in the background of many of us, and it made a big difference to us. So the tongue is the voice of the natural man. The cultured tongue is the voice of the spiritual man. And sometimes when we're listening to thoughts in our mind, we can't be sure whether they're coming from the natural man or the spiritual man. We've got to be aware of that. We know this one. This is a standard one that we go through very often. Let your women keep silence in the ecclesias. It's not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also saith the law. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shame for a woman to speak in the ecclesia. That's what we have learned. So when formal services are being conducted in the ecclesia, the women should keep silent. This scripture has a truth and a spirit aspect to it. So we would say that in some cases, a woman might, or a sister might say, well, the meeting's over. So now I can say what I like to any of the brethren because the official meeting's over, but the spirit of it would not be leading a person in that direction. So both should be honored by the sisters. A time to be silent and to speak well. In Proverbs 18, and we find a lot of this materials in Proverbs, it says, a fool's lips enter into contention, and his mouth calleth for strokes. A fool's mouth is his destruction, and his lips are the snare of his soul. The words of a talebearer are his wounds. They go down into the innermost parts of the belly. And as we grow older, we recall times, sad times in our life, whenever that is the case, of how much you can destroy with just a few words. Just like a forest fire, you know, it takes years and years and years for a forest to grow, for the wood to get the size it is, but it just takes a few minutes of intense fire and it's gone. And that's very much like how James, the Apostle James, compares the tongue. Words must be carefully chosen. When to pass on information must be equally carefully chosen. The bearer of truth and good news is not likely to inflict wounds on the receiver of them. So we would just try to default to being the bearer of good news and not evil news. So much for that then. That's side done. What I wanted to speak about in particular was the wisdom in Solomon's words that there is a time to keep silence and a time to speak. So it applies to sisters, both young and old. In general, there is a time to speak and a time to keep silent. We would know that just from the fact of the way that we've brought up, whoever brought us up, that there's a time to speak and there's a time you'd best not speak, just to be silent. So in general, we wouldn't have any difficulty agreeing with that. But that's really not where the wisdom lies. The wisdom is to see it beyond that. When is it a time to keep silent? You know, when is it a time to speak? Well, you know, looking back on our history, Sister Dorothy and I, well, I'm not sure Dorothy's right in that category yet, but you can't be very far behind. We've been in the truth 60 years. And when you've been in the truth that long, you recognize that there is a time to speak and a time not to speak. I can remember a sister, not a brother, but I can remember a sister who one night she saw a young man, a brother, in the truth, come in with a woman that was obviously of the world. She was the only one that I know went to speak to that man that night and just remind him in a very, very nice way where that behavior leads. Do you think it was a time to speak? Like a lot of people would be trying to make their mind up, and by the time they had made their mind up one way or the other, the couple had gone. So it was a time to speak, and that sister was right on the ball. It went down and just forewarned the young man that you got to just understand where that behavior can lead. It doesn't necessarily always lead that way, but you're playing with something that can severely hurt you. So again, when I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and in thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded in thee also. Now, Sister Dorothy, she could probably say more about this than me, but she would never be up here saying this. But she brought up the kids. Basically, I was very busy. I made a decision in my life. I don't know whether your husband or someone in your life could make the same decision, but we had to decide where to live. And we had six children at the time. We're trying to decide where to live, and we did not want to live in the city. We wanted to get out of the city. So I was enticed to move to Shelburne. And so we brought all our kids up to the farm, and that's where the kids really remember life, because we lived together in this old farmhouse. But that was a decision with a cost, because it was either I live beside where I work, and Dorothy has to be the one that drives to wherever she wants to be, to do with her sisters, to attend the functions of the ecclesia. Or I didn't live close to where I work. We would live ourselves close to the ecclesia, and all the household would be there, and I would drive to work. And now that's what I chose, the latter one. And I am so glad that we made that decision, because when we moved to Shelburne, well, our family was growing up with my brother Ron's family. They're all about the same age. My sister's family, they were about the same age. And my other brother and other sister weren't far behind. So there was five in the Abel family. They were all bringing up kids. I don't know how many kids we had, but we had a bunch of them, and they were all related. And a couple of their parents were teachers. So we had a spy in all the schools. Like, there was no way you could get away with anything. And the kids would tell you what went on. So we were brought up that way. And I thought, you know, that's wonderful I didn't mind paying the price of driving, but it did mean that Dorothy had to do a lot of the raising of the kids. Now, I think when you look at our grandmother Lois and a mother Eunice mentioned in the life of Timothy, that illustrates, sisters, the value of spending hundreds of hours raising kids. No recognition in society. You're not going to get a pension because you had a family. No one will recognize the housewife as being of any significance today. It seems it's just, you know, put down. So a lot of parents they're not parents, but a lot of couples don't have any children until, you know, 40 years old. I would never want to start a family at 40 years old. And maybe no one has really explained to them that you're going to be living with those kids for 20 years. So how would you feel raising these energetic teenagers when you're just approaching 60 in life? Like, there's a time to have a family, a time to raise those kids, and you miss it, you miss it. So everything in those Proverbs that Solomon said has a wisdom that relates something to our life. And I just think you've got to give credit to the record for saying that, so that a grandmother and a mother were pointed out in the faith of Timothy. One thing we know for sure, it's not passed on by genetics. Like, it has to be passed on by example. They have to learn that faith through the people that were teaching them. So certainly in the nurturing of children, there is a time to speak. And for anyone starting off or thinking of starting off in this, you have a tougher decision to make than we ever had. You've got to decide whether these little electronic devices are going to be in the hands of your children, or whether you will, when you get, you know, very busy, just tell the kids to go down and watch a movie. We didn't have that option. On the farm, you went out and you did something on the farm. That was a much better set of options than what people have today. It's just too easy to tell the kids to go while you're busy doing something, go and do something else. Well, if you don't want to do that, well, you go watch a movie. I think we'll regret that. And even in young people's, when the young people's can't decide what to do, it's strange in a house. You have all these young people over, not a sound. They're all in watching a movie. There's no sound of fellowship. There's no sound of having a good time together, because that's what they chose for entertainment. We don't want to do those things, sisters. We want to be, you know, into the work that a grandmother and a mother did to raise a young man that Paul could pick up and help work, so we could say that I know nobody else so like-minded as Timothy. I think that's a tremendous tribute to those two women. It says that the heart of the righteous studieth to answer, but the mouth of the wicked poureth out evil things. Now, when you're using the Bible to give you the parameters of a subject, and you try to find everything that you can, you really have to pay attention to that, because that's where the tongue fails. The tongue answers so quickly, and some people more quick than others, that it doesn't study to answer. It doesn't give any attention to the fact that, hey, you've got to think a little bit here now. So how you respond to this, you've got to just survey, why did you hear what you heard? Are you hearing the person who's just wanted to be smart with you? Are you listening to the person who's hurting in some way? Person who needs help? Like, that's all the things that you're trying to decide based on a few words you've heard. If you answer very quickly and you get it wrong, it may not be worth saying anything further. So it pays to take time before replying to words or actions. And the idea of studieth is, interestingly, to moan, growl, utter. Like, this is the way it's translated. I don't think you would moan or growl or utter or muse or mutter, but you might meditate and devise and plot before you speak. So although it's translated those other ways, the idea, the sense of the heart of the righteous, this is not the heart of the unrighteous, but the heart of the righteous, yes, they would. They'd meditate. They would think a little before they spoke. Otherwise, we just pour out wicked things that is associated with the very opposite. In Proverbs 15, it says, "The eyes of Yahweh are in every place, beholding the evil and the good." A wholesome tongue is a tree of life, but perverseness therein is a breach in the spirit. Now we're trying to concentrate on these positive things because you wouldn't normally think that a wholesome tongue could be compared to a tree of life. So you have to think about that a little bit. Like, what would we think of as a tree of life? But some kind of a tree whose fruit is able to reinforce, to enrich, to give a new place to grow. A wholesome tongue is providing a lot of things for a person who needs it, especially when it's compared to a tree of life. See, you see what a tongue can be, but if you don't know when to speak, or you're hesitant and you miss the time to speak, then it really doesn't matter because we've missed it. A wholesome tongue is a tree of life, but it has to be at the time to speak. So the tongue itself is not the point of this statement. Wholesome means curative, wise, life-giving in its instruction. So you really have to take some time. And that's why, you know, in some cases, people have to be up and early at it. In the days, I probably learned this more from a woman I taught than I did from a sister. But I was teaching in engineering. It was robotics engineering. And one class that started off in September was, there was a woman in it, and she was old enough to have 5 children, all of school age, of which she told me right off the very first class that she put them in school before she came to class. Can you imagine how structured she'd have to live in her life to put 5 children in school and then come to school herself? Well, that woman amazed me because I went into the classroom more than once to get started myself and found her sitting in the row, all her books open, looking there, waiting for people to arrive so she could start learning. Like that, she was up, must have been up very early, organized, got it all done, and there she was. And that lady went on to get the top honors in the whole of that first year of students. And I just had, you know, a lot of admiration for somebody who could have their life so much together that she could do all that in the morning. Well, the other kids were coming in, you know, they have these big, tall Tim Hortons sitting there, and they can't get their books out of the bag, and they're sitting at me bent over the table looking at it, and they look like their person's about 20 years older than they are, addicted to coffee already. So it's all in your head how you do this, but a wholesome tongue is a tree of life. And as we can pass that on to our children and to other children, that's the object of this scripture and of this textbook that we're learning from. Here we are. Let's just go on to the next one. And, you know, there's just an abundance of these. I've just put in the number I sort of felt we could get through in the time we have, but it goes on and on. So Proverbs 15, verse 23, a man hath joy by the answer of his mouth, and a word spoken in due season, how good it is. But who can recognize the due season? And if you'd recognize the season, who has the good word ready? So it all speaks of preparation. And I've never known preparation in something like this, in what involves speaking, to be other than related to memory work. So that if you did a little study, that if I'd like to say something that's encouraging to someone, and I'd like to be able to cheer somebody up, especially if I recognize in just the way a person's walking, or just in the way they're looking, or in something I know about what's happening in their life, I'd just like to say a word of encouragement, that I don't have to think it up on the spot, because I've already thought it up, and I got it memorized. And that's using mnemonics. That's using a system whereby you put the words of what you want to say together in a word that you can remember. You either put that in your Bible, or you, better still, mark it in your mind. Now, I've tried these things, and I've been working with them for, well, since maybe the early 60s when we were going down to Ellen Gardens, and you needed to remember things, so you never had time to think down there. And so in my back of my Bible, I still have words that I made back in the 60s, and I can still remember them. Now, that's the kind of thing that God gave us the capability of doing, of doing a study. This is what I would say under these conditions, and then structuring it. And this is the order in which I would present it, so that if someone came and I thought, boy, I'd love to say something to that person, or I'd like to write them a little note, or I'd like to pass them on a message some way just to help them, you know, what to say, because life is so busy, it's very difficult to generate it on the spot. Better to have done the study, have it stored away. So we have joy by the answer of our mouth, that is a word spoken in due season. So there must be a skill in being able to speak a word in season, first to recognize the season, and next to fashion suitable words in a given amount of time. That's where I think the wisdom lies in that aspect. Yeah, we need the practice. In Proverbs 16, verses 23 to 25, it says, "The heart of the wise teacheth his mouth and addeth learning to his lips. Pleasant words are as a honeycomb, sweet to the soul, health to the bones. There is a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death." Now, these pleasant words, sisters, I do not believe would be humorous. Like, a lot of people have a rapport with one another by humor. And sometimes it's sarcastic humor. And seeing how sarcastic your remark can be is the cleverness of your humor. So you look at someone and they're not maybe, you know, haven't got their shirt on right or their tie's not on right, and you make a mark about that and something, they must have got up late this morning or something like that. Those can be the most hurtful remarks you'd ever want to make, because you have no idea what was the reason for those things. It's just, if you have a rapport that's sarcastic with a person, you want to change that rapport. Because I don't think pleasant words involve humor necessarily. They may involve humor, but sarcasm is a bit too extreme. It's got to be something sweet to the soul, health to the bones, something that will help and encourage. Yeah, because I don't know why those verses 24 and 25 are together, but it always seems to me that there is some reason behind it. If there is a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death, then we want to make sure that we don't fall into that trap of speaking too quickly or not speaking at all. So if you wanted to apply some healing to a person who was sick, pleasant words, sweet to the soul, health to the bones would fit the occasion. So quite often when we want to say something to a person who needs a little comfort, how do you open the conversation? Many conversations, even in the truth, start off with the weather. They start off with mundane things, because we haven't given enough time to actually make sure that we know of pleasant words. We know of words that will be health to the bones. So sisters, any investment in that would help us. Didn't want to do that. We'll just hit this one. Proverbs 25. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in pictures of silver. As an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold, so is a wise reprover upon an obedient ear. Like, why are all these things in the Proverbs? Why are all these comparisons of words fitly spoken there? Except for a very wise man who knew how to encourage people and what real wisdom, valuable wisdom, is like. It is like apples of gold and pictures of, that's beautiful language of an apple of gold and a picture of silver. We wouldn't normally put those things together, but it sounds beautiful. And it's nothing about apples of gold and pictures of silver. It's about a word fitly spoken. It's beautiful. That's what we really want to make our conversation like. There's a beauty in words. There are also words of reproof that are much needed at the critical time. And just while I'm thinking of it, I've noticed many times too often, and you know, even in my own life when Sister Dorothy and I were raising our kids, that you didn't stand behind what you said. Now, sisters, you generally need a brother to help you in that regard. And if you're married, you have children, you have a husband with you who can reinforce things. I always felt that way to Dorothy. Dorothy never put me into the embarrassing, untenable position of, here's the spanking list when I came home from work. These are the things they did. These kids need to be disciplined. They're getting out of hand. She never did that. They may have not got all the discipline they needed, but I was able to recognize it. And one thing I would not allow my children to do is to mouth their mother. And if you find your kids are doing that to you, you need help from your husband, or you need to correct it in some way. Kids speaking back to their mom are not speaking respectively. They need to respect their mother. That's the first commandment with promise, to obey your parents, your mom and your dad. Kids have got to learn that. But when you tell your children to do something and they don't do it, and you do nothing about it, you're not reinforcing that commandment. We've got to learn that when we tell our children something, to make sure they do it so they understand that there's a follow-up. Otherwise, don't tell them to do it. Rather not tell them to do it than tell them to do it and don't do anything about it when they don't follow through. That seems to be more and more apparent, that mothers and fathers are maybe not as disciplined in that matter as they ought to be. A soft answer turneth away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. Now, that's a real skill. Because if you could teach people that, that would be a very valuable thing to pass on. How to create a soft answer to turn away wrath. Because in most cases, grievous words stir up anger. And the anger is in the person who should be giving a soft answer, but can't because of the anger based on the words that someone else spoke. And that's where children are. I remember my mother telling me that there's a little saying that sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you. And yet one of the siblings calling another a name, where it might just be a mocking of you in some way, seemed to always be so hurtful. And that's about as good as my mom could come up with. I remember her saying that many times. But the tongue of the wise useth knowledge aright, but the mouth of the fools poureth out foolishness. I mean, just going through the Proverbs and checking these all off and seeing if you can put some together, some kind of a word that would lead you in your mind quickly. I don't believe that could ever happen without putting the work into making it. Like, even if you remembered any particular one, if you hadn't really thought, well, what is a soft answer? How would you describe a soft answer? But if you just remember that when Saul and David had that exchange, when they were in the cave and Saul went out of it and David called after Saul, and Saul was able to understand that he'd been right beside David and David could have killed him and he didn't. It wasn't an answer necessarily by words, but it was an answer indeed. But it was an answer. And Saul just wept. Here was a man that came out to kill David, and he went away weeping. You can well imagine what his armored troops would have thought about this. They brought him all the way down in the wilderness to capture David. And when they get to the chance that they could have taken him, the leader is weeping about the fact that he even went to look after David. But you see, that was the answer. It wasn't in words, it was in what David did to save his life that brought Saul around, only for a time, and he was up to it again, but he had the same response another time. So there is many Bible examples that give us further support of these things if we need it. So this applies to most situations. A soft answer turns away wrath. It's appropriate. It's effective. It sets a great example. It's to be valued. And if we can teach that to our children, what a remarkable skill that would be, to see a child that can actually grasp that, practice it, and manage it in his or her life. That would be a wonderful thing, to know how to reply with a soft answer to turn away wrath. Now, just in finishing this off, there's a few more that sort of just up the ante a little bit of this. So in Proverbs 15, A fool despiseth his father's instruction, but he that regardeth reproof is prudent. In the house of the righteous is much treasure, but in the revenues of the wicked is trouble. The lips of the wise disperse knowledge, but the heart of the foolish doeth not so. So there is a time to disperse knowledge. Now, that's where I think a sister is probably better situated to do something with the children than a man is, although some men are very good at this and love to do this. But it's a very wonderful bond to have with your children when they want to sit right on your knee and listen to a story. It's just sad that in our community we don't have better or more of Christadelphian works that would teach lessons that we value based on the Word of God, and we have to go to, you know, the big bad wolf. Kids love it, but, you know, what does it really teach them? And surely there's enough creativity amongst all you sisters that, you know, you could create some further works that would help young children to understand the basic values that we're talking about so that we can disperse knowledge while we're reading those books. And Dorothy and I used to love to see how quickly children would be into a story with imagination. You did not have to have pictures. You did not have to have a movie. You didn't have to have, didn't have to have any imagination at all, because as soon as you started reading the story or telling the story, you could tell by the kids' eyes, they're with you. Just keep talking. They're right with you. God gave us an imagination. The world has taken the imagination to give them a virtual reality. It's not reality to see little fairies going around with wings and flying here and there. It might be pretty and all that, but that's not reality. Reality is what the Word of God talks about. And we don't want to go down this road of virtual reality. We don't want to go down the gaming route that so many kids go down. You see them there intently working out a game. That's not reality. Reality is dealing with the issues of life. And we can set up some habits, some very bad habits, by just letting kids have these things, letting them play with, explore with them, when in fact, having that time together with them and dispersing knowledge thereby is really where we want to be. Wisdom will be required to know when and how. So here's another one. Now, in our Christadelphian community, I'm sure this is something that we can all benefit from. Our girls got together because the girls are very, very much united, and to them it's kind of interesting to know what somebody else had for breakfast. I don't really have any interest in that at all, but the girls do. And they communicate with each other on WhatsApp. You ever heard of WhatsApp? It's actually really brought the kids together. We got one in Australia, we got one in Halifax, we got a couple in Detroit, we got a couple in Ontario, separated by, you know, a couple hundred miles. And these kids communicate together and build their life together. They talk about things that happen, they talk about their children, they show each other what's going on. And it's been really wonderful to try to keep the family together in that sense. And where that we have the sons involved, they're not nearly as good as that, but their wives are pretty good. So they figure in well too. But good news from a far country, we're told it's like cold waters to a thirsty soul to be able to hear something from someone who lives a long way away and be able to keep in close touch. Maybe one of the good things that you can say the electronic devices have got for us. So to be resourceful in speaking, whether by word of mouth, pen, email, one needs to be conscious of the needs of others and how a word of encouragement will be received. So if one of the children is baptized, grandchildren are baptized, it's one thing that everybody applauds and always very, very happy about. And it's so nice to see that connection together. Ointment and perfume rejoice the heart, so doth the sweetness of a man's friend by hearty counsel. And from time to time, that's what you have to try to come up with. Someone's got a problem, they can't resolve it. I don't mean a cooking problem or a house, like, you know, a domestic problem, but they have some problem with maybe one of their children. They can't figure out what to do with this. What do you do in that situation? Well, if you've got something to say, to take a few minutes and to send it the way we can communicate so easily today, would certainly be an answer to that proverb. So like the counsel of Abigail gave to David, you wouldn't expect that a woman in that sense would have been able to help David, but she did, and David appreciated what she had to say to him. So it was a unique time to speak, and it led to the saving of a lot of bloodshed. David was grateful. Now, this proverb just takes us a little further in what is really meant by it. Like, why would the proverb say, "My reins shall rejoice when thy lips speak right things"? The reins is kidneys. Otherwise, it would be translated kidneys. But I guess the translators didn't think it should be kidneys there, so they said reins. But it's speaking about the emotions. Our emotions shall rejoice when thy lips speak right things. Well, the Apostle John said, I have no greater joy than to know that my children walk in the truth. That's a great joy to us. So it's something that we need to consider, the emotions that are behind or associated with these things. Figuratively speaking, the reins represent the kidneys. Our consciences witness to the right and wrong of our behavior. It's refreshing when our consciences witness to the fitness and truth of an event. So you can go home really feeling, or you can, you know, stop in your communication by really feeling it was a worthwhile time spent to communicate something to help someone else. And then in this one, I really don't have much experience in teaching and admonishing one another in hymns and spiritual songs, because I have never been able to really remember hymns. I can remember these mnemonic words and things that I've studied, but when it comes to hymns, I just never ever sang when I was a child. We didn't have choirs like you have today, so young people didn't sing together. And I guess I could have learned a lot of things. I was just thrilled, about 10 years ago, when a few young people from this part of the world came and joined us when the papal visit occurred in Toronto. And the young people got together. We had a week together. We were going to do something for that particular weekend. And we walked through a big mall in Toronto to the event. And they were all singing one of the songs that Brother Dan wrote. It's about 10 years ago. And I will never forget it. I don't think they will either, because they were walking in single file through the doors and through the mall, and they were all singing. Everybody's looking at these young people. They weren't in a group. They were in a single file, but they were all singing. I just wish I could remember what the name of the song was. Anybody was here? Because there's a few of you who may very well have been there. I know some of the young men were there, and they mentioned it to me just a little while ago. So, but anyway, that's a wonderful thing to teach and admonish one another in psalms and hymns. And I really hope that the young people follow that pattern, because I think that's a wonderful endeavor. To admonish one means to put in mind or reprove gently. There must be a skill of doing this effectively. Figuratively speaking, the reins represent the kidneys, and our conscience is witness to the right or wrong of our behavior. And I think we've seen those before on the last one. And now, this is the last one. Actually, there's one more. This particular one, Titus chapter 2, is something that I don't really know the sisters ever paid much attention to this. I just wish you would. From time to time when it's being brought up, the old sisters say, well, the young sisters don't want to listen to us. And young sisters, I don't know why they wouldn't listen or want the advice from older sisters. But look at what the apostle says they were to communicate. The aged woman likewise, that they be in behavior as becometh holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, and to love their children. Is that ever done? I mean, you might do it on a personal basis, but it would ever be done on a formal basis where you'd have a class, a sister's class, where the actual intent was for older sisters to speak up in front of the younger sisters of how to love their husbands. Like you assuming that a husband needs help. And as a husband, I really appreciate the value of a wife who understands what we're trying to achieve as brethren. So I would know what I would say, but it's not for a brethren to teach this. It's the older women to teach this, to teach the younger women how to love their husbands. And do you think that younger women just know how to love their husbands? That's a false understanding of it. They don't know just how to love their husband or to let it work out the way it could work out. They need the instruction of people who have been through this for 30, 40, 50 years to be able to tell them, look, this is what can happen. This is what you should do. This is how you love your husband. Or to love their children. Doesn't everyone just know how to love children? No, they surely don't. And the problem is that before they recognize it, the children are almost too old to be instructed. They're off to behavior patterns already. So there's some things there that really could be fleshed out in classes. But this is the one where I think it's... Now that's just a little bit more of the same. Just looking at the words there, they're not the agape word. They're the filial word, fond of man, fond of children. So you know it's not using the agape root. It's using just how to love them, and to be affectionate as a wife, to be affectionate, a lover of the children. This is the one I wanted to end with. Is how do you teach without saying a word? Now, isn't it interesting that you could see the wisdom of that proverb? There's a time to be silent and a time to speak to win your husband. And it's not a time to speak. It's a time to be silent because you're really communicating, but you're not communicating by the tongue. You're communicating by your conduct. And it says that they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives when they see your respectful and pure conduct. That's the ESV. There's a lot of work to be done to fill out that little part of all those things that he says there's a time for and a time not to do it. This is just speaking, and you can see how they can all be fleshed out like that. There's a lot of wisdom contained in these things, And maybe there's a few ideas that would help there and when you think about it later on. So it will take a lot of self-control, which is governed by the objective of being clear. There's a time to let the lips be silent, but the activities otherwise undertaken will speak volumes. And I just wanted to go by summary. The tongue's untamable. We should keep silence, or sisters should keep silence in the ecclesia. Silent to gossip. Speak to children, study to answer, the cause for a wholesome tongue to be like a tree of life. There's a word in season, there's pleasant words, a word fitly spoken, a soft answer, a far country, hearty counsel, a conscience rejoices, spiritual songs, teaching on women, one without a word. You could make up a really good mnemonic with that. But just taking those things and putting them together and structuring it so you could remember it. And that's just one subject. That's where our Bible leads us. It's a wonderful book. It covers many, many cases that otherwise we would ponder and ponder to no value at all by our normal mind. So I just leave it as the end of the beginning. And the rest of it is up to you, sisters, to do what you can. Thank you.